Refugees are continuing to flee the fighting in Ukraine. To date, according to the UN, more than 10 million people have left their lives behind, many also leaving loved ones. They are making the journey to Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, Romania, Moldova, Belarus, and even to Russia. Here in the UK, more than 21,000 visas have been issued to Ukrainians who have immediate or extended family in Britain. And around 2,700 visas have been issued to British families, welcoming refugees into their homes. Although the government has been criticised for the Homes for Ukraine scheme, as more than 38,000 applications have been made to date. To tell us more about all of this is Dr. Michelle Ritchie, who recently took part in an event focused on supporting Ukrainian refugees. Hello, Michelle. How are you?
Hi, good, thanks, Peter. Nice to be with you today.
Oh, good, good. It's good to have you. If you wouldn't mind starting by telling us a bit about yourself and a bit about your background and what you do.
Sure. So my name's Michelle Ritchie. I'm a lecturer in technology and entrepreneurship, and I'm in the university. I'm based in the School of Business and Economics. And broadly speaking, in the longer term, my research interests focus on technology and business for social good, responding to social problems and social change. So that's the kind of bigger background. And I first became involved in research that involves refugees back in 2015, during the so-called European refugee crisis, which seems like a long time ago in our memories now. I was personally involved as a volunteer and just began to see that there was a lot of need for more evidence-based approaches, for the evidence base to just be strengthened in support of best practice and also policy initiatives and all sorts of things. So I also began to see that probably each of us in our own positions has something unique to offer to any of these situations above and beyond just simply humanitarian kind of empathetic actions. So I started to look around from my position in the business school to see where can I make best use of my position and my skills. And I started off with a social enterprise based in London called the Entrepreneurial Refugee Network, who were using business and organizing as a way of offering livelihood strategies to refugees who were being locked out of the kind of work and employment opportunities.
Yeah, that was that's one of my questions that I've got for you later. Actually, it's about what do refugees actually do? Like, once you've been given a visa or status, how do you support your family from there? You know, you're in a completely new, different place. You're just probably might not speak the language, you know, where do you go? But yeah, we'll cover that later.
Yeah,
Were you involved with any Ukrainian refugees back in 2015 then? Because there was a migration crisis then in 14, wasn't there? 2014, 2015.
Yeah, it was slightly after that I got directly personally involved. But the honest truth is, although we see these crises kind of in isolation, they're really not in isolation at all. And the global picture is, actually, best estimates are that, you know, 1% of the world's population is now displaced. And this crisis comes off the back of most recently, you know, the US withdrawal from Afghanistan, which is quite recent in our memories. Of course, the war in Syria and all sorts of ongoing protracted conflicts all over the world. So what we're seeing is both the immediate pressing needs associated with forced migration are intensifying. The speed and scope of this current crisis in Ukraine is unseen and unheard of since the Second World War. More refugees moving more quickly than any time since then. But it comes off the back of all of those other crises. So the system that we have in place, largely overseen by UNHCR, is creaking at the seams, quite frankly, to cope with these successive crises that just keep coming and coming and getting larger and larger and closer to all nations, really.
So who are these refugees? We know that a lot of the men have stayed back to fight. Are we looking at just sort of mothers and their children, elderly people, people who are sick? Who are they?
Yeah, we always have imperfect data from any kind of ongoing crisis situation. The best data we get is from the IOM, which is an arm of the UN, and who have been surveying kind of samples of this population on the move. They estimate between 50 and 60% are women. And anyone that they surveyed that had, wherever there was a head of household, be that male or female, 50% of them had children with them. There's also all sorts of complex needs of people, because you're talking about a whole society on the move, really. So there's people who are in vulnerable categories, people with illnesses in need of medication, people who were in the middle of undergoing treatments, and the elderly on the move as well. So you're looking at a whole society on the move, with any of the complexity that would entail for our society were we on the move. And it's useful to imagine it, you know, in relation to ourselves and what that would look like for ourselves were the same situation to be true here.
Yeah. So most, as we've heard, most have gone over to Poland. So I think there's just over 2 million people who've gone there. And then the other countries are Romania, Moldova, and even Russia and Belarus.
Yes.
Can you tell me first about what will they expect to find when they get over the border? What will be there to greet them? I mean, presumably they aren't just handed visas straight away and told to go and settle down. What happens?
Yeah, well, there's various reasons that people might head in the direction of Russia and Belarus. And those are all so diverse, really. Oftentimes you find people making those decisions based on things like family connections, because you move from insecurity to try and find security somewhere. So, you know, we've heard a lot about this in the news, haven't we, that there's such close connections between Russia and the Ukraine, family groups that, you know, that transcend that kind of national boundary. So people are, I would guess, are moving because the language there will be easy for them to pick up. Many people will be Russian speakers, will have Russian family there. I'm not sure I'm well placed to say what greets them there, but they probably face kind of similar issues with resettlement as you would in many countries.
Yeah.
And that is that, you know, the struggle to do many things at once, to find housing, to find a source of livelihood, to get your visa sorted out. And the hope in any of those situations is that this is temporary. Most people you hear, as with any refugees, say that they want to return home. The prospects for that don't look very hopeful at the minute, and we see that a lot again in the refugee system, is that it's there to cope with emergency needs and temporary accommodation of these needs, but actually what we're not talking about at the moment in this crisis situation is that the average length of time for someone to be seeking asylum and in a refugee situation at the moment, it's actually 17 years. That's a global average. So it's not a temporary state. No. It's no longer, we've got to start reframing how we think about this, and thinking not only about these kind of immediate term, you know, 3-year visas, but how do we build capacity out to deal with much longer term displacement?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you probably guess from my surname that I'm Polish, and there's only one way I suppose there's a number of ways I got here, but it was my grandparents who were all refugees, and they sort of they came here after the Second World War, and they integrated fairly well. So, I mean, is there lessons that we can learn from what happened after the Second World War?
Yeah, massively. And I think it's useful to look back and see that, you know, we always look back on very things that we're very proud of in the Second World War, like I've heard a lot of people making reference to the Kinder transport. We can't forget that there's still a very checkered history with that. You know, we allowed all these children to arrive, but we didn't allow their parents to come with them. So we've still got to remember, you know, we've got to take a hard look at ourselves and our policies, I think, and how kind of open and inclusive some of these policies have historically been. And I think one thing that we can learn from recent history is what the UN Secretary General has said at the moment is that he feels that the compassionate kind of outpouring of empathy that we've seen this time is one of the silver linings of what's happening at the minute, and that even countries that were lurching towards much more draconian kind of refugee systems, like the UK and the Netherlands as well, have had to backtrack and think initially were kind of harder line requirements for visas, but it, in the context of a great outpouring of public support and empathy, they've been encouraged and pushed towards having slightly more open policies and open, we'll get onto those in a minute, I'm sure.
Poland itself as well was very anti, immigration as well before this. For some reason, there's just this complete U-turn, and they've obviously they've welcomed so many people.
Yeah, and I think part of it is this kind of thing. These are our close European neighbours, and I think one of the things that this crisis has done is create a couple of really seismic shifts in what we think about refugees. Like, there's a really oft-quoted number from the a UN figure that 85% of the world's refugees are in low- and middle-income countries. That is actually, in light of this crisis, no longer the case. In fact, Europe now hosts more refugees than any other region of the world in light of this crisis. Oh. So it's created this huge shift. It's that close neighbouring country, but we can't, again, we can't fool ourselves, because our initial responses, say, to the Syrian refugee crisis were very empathetic. Backlash always lurks around the corner, you know, because our initial kind of compassion, the initial compassion shown, the initial empathy. I mean, in Poland, you're right, there's been a huge outpouring of support and empathy, but already, you know, strollers being left at the train stations and, you know, people arriving to pick people up, just fine and pick people up. There's been a great pride in that kind of response in Poland. And I've as well got close Polish friends and neighbours who've felt very proud of the response, but who've also said there's a limit to how much we can do this on a humanitarian basis, because how do we pay for all of this, and where do we actually put people? And so this is part of the message and the work that's being done with the network that I'm part of, actually, is that it is the right time at the moment to be talking about immediate responses and organizing in a crisis, and how do we harness this kind of public empathy to move things in a more open and inclusive direction for all refugees, and not only our most recent arrivals, but all of these things have to also you have to think about the longer term system. And at the moment, it's a humanitarian system. We try and offshore our borders and keep the large majority of this growing number of refugees in camps, even in detention centres, and a tremendous cost. And a lot of the discussion now is about how do you make that system, which is only growing and it is only going to come under more pressure. I mean, this past few years has shown us it's not refugee displacement. It's not an isolated incident, is it? These are successive crises. And actually, one thing at the moment, you know, in a crisis situation, there's going to be a time to think about this further down the line. This is all bound up in the climate environment, the impending environmental crisis as well, because a lot of people are not only displaced by politics and war and threat of violence. So the UN definition of a refugee is someone fleeing because of a well-founded fear of persecution. That doesn't really adequately cover at the moment people who are displaced by environmental catastrophes, who are also seeking asylum, who are also seeking safety. And actually, the World Bank have predicted that by 2050, we're looking at somewhere around 143 million refugees globally. You know, so this is a growing crisis. And one of the things that the network that I work in that looks at, how can we orient this system to not only cope with a crisis in the short term, but to, as successive waves come in, how can we make this a sustainable system that has the capacity to cope with these growing numbers and can do that at scale sustainably? Business likes to think it's really well oriented towards those kinds of solutions, and innovation and technology all play a role in that. Mm-hmm. But that's the push that's coming from our own school, from this network of investors and businesses that I work in, and also from places like the Refugee Studies Centre at Oxford, who are saying, you know, for this to be sustainable, for this to operate at scale, we've got to start thinking about not so much a humanitarian system that is there for crisis situations like this, but in the longer term, we've got to couple that with an opportunity-oriented system that gives, for example, asylum seekers the opportunity to work, which is good for them, which takes that cost burden off their receiving countries a little bit.
Yeah.
Also, you know, we can see from a personal point of view.
How does that work then? What barriers are there between an asylum seeker or refugee coming to this country or any country and getting a job? And how will what you're looking at help that? How will it break those barriers down?
That's a great question. So at the moment, there are tremendous barriers all over the place to refugees and asylum seekers. So just to make the distinction, an asylum seeker is someone who arrives spontaneously in a country seeking safety. And when they're granted that right to remain, they become a refugee. So you are granted refugee status. So it's important to make that distinction because you have different rights in both of those circumstances. So for example, currently in the UK, asylum seekers are not granted the right to work. In fact, most recently, that's been debated in the House of Lords, and the House of Lords have supported a move that after 6 months, asylum seekers should be given the right to work whilst their claim is being processed. But at the moment, that's facing stiff opposition in the House of Commons.
What's the opposition? What's the reason?
So in the House of Commons, there's a number of dynamics going on. But one of the things that I observe is that quite often they conflate different kinds of migration and different issues with asylum. So for example, the stickiness we're seeing in this system at the moment is because they are worried about the security risks posed by people coming into the country. And that's a really common objection raised in the House of Commons.
Yeah, particularly for all sorts of things.
So security concerns, it's part of the rising kind of nationalist sentiment, I think. And in line with that, they conflate all sorts of issues, migration issues, people that we might refer to as economic migrants who don't flee their own countries because of safety or concerns, but come just seeking opportunities for better livelihoods or better chances for their kids. Those people are not covered by the refugee kind of international refugee conventions or ethical kind of moral obligations, but they're often... those two groups are conflated. And so there's a lot of debate. And really, I think what it comes down to is that it's seen as an electable issue, that if you can control migration, migration is seen as being to blame for other issues that are going on in our economy, places that haven't had, job security for a long time, areas up north where there's kind of deindustrialization. Yeah. And they conflate all of these issues. I mean, we saw back in 2015, the Brexit campaign really conflating these issues, didn't we? These photographs that we saw of this inward flux of people who were supposed to be stealing jobs and threatening British kind of prospects. All of these things are conflated, and what we really need to do is just untangle them, because actually 70% of people who apply for asylum are granted asylum quite rapidly, which means that there are grounds for them to seek safety and resettlement. So we do have to be seen as a legitimate international state. We have to fulfill these moral obligations to people. We have to allow them to seek safety as a human right. So untangling some of those issues for our politicians in the House of Commons is really, really important. They can't continue to kind of scapegoat refugees who seem to be at the sharp end of a lot of the blame game.
Do you think this will change that slightly now? Because it's a lot harder to sort of roll out some of these tropes when we went, these people are a lot of British people see these as our European neighbours.
Yes.
And they are a lot more welcoming. And do you think that some of these sort of these populist ideas won't hold with what's going on at the minute?
Yeah, I think for the moment, it seems like a hopeful opportunity.
Yeah.
Because it is, I mean, in the UK, we can see that it's in light of that huge outpouring, but somewhere between 100,000, 150,000 people now have signed up to host a refugee in their home. And it's that huge public kind of outpouring of support that pushed the government, who were initially only going to allow Ukrainians with family members in the UK. So you can see that, you know, public sentiment can really soften some of these policies. And, you know, as always, if our politicians see this as an election issue, that's when they prioritize it.
So absolutely,
there is a hopeful moment. There is a hopeful moment. And, you know, we can see that, you know, in the past as well. Other conflicts in which there were outpourings of support and then changes in some of the international or European policies. I think it's called the Dublin Agreement. This is stretching my memory now. You might want to edit this bit. But European policy is also shaped by some of these dynamics, really. And public sentiment really does have a moment. But again, I think one of the things that makes that public support sustainable is that, and then we see this in other areas of the world, actually. So there's some interesting case in points in areas of the world that we're doing some research in particularly in Africa, that bears quite a heavy burden of displacement kind of internationally. Yeah. And it's not only Europe where there's kind of, you know, unequal treatment of refugees from different countries and different responses to one group and then another. That happens, you know, all over the world. What seems to work, the model that seems to work, is that where crisis and humanitarian responses serve an immediate and pressing need, they can be coupled with inward development in things like infrastructure, where local people share in the benefits of, you know, receiving and hosting new groups. And that's worked. That's worked very well in Africa. And it's what Poland are crying out for at the moment, actually, and saying, you know, right, I can open up my hotel for so long, but I need this to be sustainable. So inward development especially regions that traditionally would struggle, those tend to be the areas that host a lot of refugees. Yeah. So inward investment, things like schools and roads and simple things like that. And then an opportunity-oriented approach. So job creation, financial investment from big corporations. We've seen, again, like kind of a grassroots swell of support, you know, support in principle for these kinds of ideas. There's a coalition of businesses, I'm sure you probably saw, Peter, in the news, who were saying, right, we need workers. There's going to be an influx of people. We're going to sign up to make sure that there's jobs available for some of these incoming people. And a huge group of British businesses have made that kind of public commitment. There's a commitment in principle, I think, to the idea that, you know, it makes a lot more sense for people to be able to work, to be able to support themselves and to be able to kind of do things more sustainably. It's been depressing, really, to see some of the people in my own research, as I've spoken to people who have been resettled, you know, in different waves, for different reasons from different regions of the world. But some of them have been, their asylum claim has taken some, you know, between 6 to 11 years or more to process, and in that time their right to work has been suspended, and whether they would prefer it or not, they're constrained to live off social security, you know, social housing. That's not only a tremendous cost to the government, but it's also a huge waste of their human talent. Because part of their recovery and their re-emergence from this awful experience is, I can get on with work. I can start to move forward. You know, I can have something to hope for in the future. I can contribute to my local community. And most people you speak to, in fact, there's none that I've spoken to that haven't wanted to do that.
Is it just bureaucracy then that's sort of clogging up the system? Why does it take so long?
Some of the cases are complex.
Yeah.
I think we're seeing this in the current situation, actually. So there's a lot of burden of proof placed on the person seeking asylum.
Yeah.
To prove the reasons that they fled, to prove their status in their home country. You know, when you flee, you often don't have time to bring a lot of bank statements with you or paperwork. No, and again, that's a criticism that's currently being levelled at the government's kind of approach to the Housing for Refugees initiative, is that the paperwork that's required, the Ukrainians simply don't have. You know, many of them are on computers in bomb shelters with intermittent access to the internet and filling in long forms on a very glitchy website. And I mean, it's just an extreme example of what this process can be like. You know, the forms can be fairly opaque or require you to have documents that you simply don't have when you've fled.
Well, you mentioned the number of applications from British people opening their homes, and they've granted just under 3,000 visas. So from 150,000 people showing interest, 2,700 have actually been granted, which is just, it's received a lot of criticism for that.
It's been very frustrating for people, hasn't it? Very frustrating because you open your home feeling the urgency of the situation for people, and you know how urgent it is. And I can only imagine that people have gone through their lives to just assess, can I do this, and to respond quickly, and to be faced with all these bureaucratic delays is a headache, to say the least. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I think that giving direction working with this kind of groundswell of empathy, it's a really important moment for the government to get this right. But what people have shown is where, time and time again, where the government or local administration can't move quick enough, they'll simply try and organise around it. And there's some great examples of that from, you know, conflicts and influxes of migrants in the recent past. And, you know, there's hubs of activity where you see these things taking place. And oftentimes in mainland Europe, train stations are the place where these things happen, because these are the arrival points for people. Yeah. You know, people coming by car or towards a checkpoint, or coming on train to a train station. And we've seen the strollers be there as quite a moving display of solidarity, recognizing that there's a lot of women and children on the move. There's a great, well documented example of grassroots organizing at a train station in Vienna during the 2015-16 influx of people as well, where self-organized at the local train station in Vienna, people had got a really smooth operation, and it was manned purely by volunteers. And in the end, the local kind of government had to just kind of give way and defer to this group of volunteers on what was going on the ground. Where could people get the things they needed? Where could they go for housing? Because it just wasn't moving quick enough.
Yeah, otherwise. That sounds lovely.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's brilliant. I think we'll leave it there, Michelle. That's been really, really nice to hear you talk. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Peter.
Thank you very much. You too. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening or watching if you're on YouTube. This show is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all other platforms. I hope you join us again.